all in all, it is not a waste. If you have a two-handed backhand, know that you can slide further to the right when you are playing the right, because you can cover more that is to your left when you have a two-handed backhand. Okay, so we are back with another episode of my podcast. We're just going to get right into it because I taught a couple great clinics this past weekend. Taught one in Westchester with my friends Ryan and Ivan. Taught one in Manhattan with Andy Peak. Both went amazingly well. I love going up there and I cannot wait to go back. I've just been pretty busy, so we're just going to get right into it. There's been a lot going on. I've been super focused on this newsletter. I've got a couple people that I'm working with on it. And we have just been putting a ton of time into this thing. I think it's going to be great. It's going to be a really, really high level newsletter, because I would be surprised if there's anybody else putting this much effort into a silly coaching and drilling and instructional newsletter. So if you haven't signed up yet, I would do it. I would sign up. I would go to my Instagram bio, or I would go to james-ignatowicz.com and sign up for the newsletter, because it's coming out in 2 weeks and there's going to be a lot in that newsletter. So without further ado, we're going to get to it. Actually, two times at this past clinic, there were two separate players who said to me that, you know, if I play the right, it would be a waste of my two-handed backhand. Not me, them, their two-handed backhand. They feel like because they have a two-handed backhand, they should be playing the left, because that's what they see all the better left side players do, using a two-handed backhand. They see the best right side players like Matt Wright or Colin Johns or Dylan Frazier only really using one hand on their backhand, at least as it relates to countering. So I think that's a bit of a myth. And I think that there are some big advantages to having a two-handed backhand when you are playing the right side of the court. So when you play the right side of the court, and I did, my only PPA gold in men's doubles is on the right side of the court, even though now I do exclusively play the left side of the court in my current partnership with Matt Wright. When you're on the right side of the court, you are taught to slide to the right so that you can hit a backhand. And this is for righties on the right. You're taught to slide to the right so that you can hit a backhand for the most part, because you can cover more space with your backhand than with your forehand. And this is all true. So one thing about that, though, is that when you slide, you're leaving some middle open. And if they're trying to find the down the line shot to your right shoulder, it's probably better just to slide and hit a backhand there, because if you slide into it with your forehand, it's a lot easier to get jammed up if it does go right at your chest. And if people are speeding it up in your general area, if you're not covering the literal center of you, which one could argue might technically be the most likely spot for the ball to go, if somebody's hitting it in your direction and they can go here, here, or here, then at a pretty high frequency, I would imagine it would be coming right in between those two spots. And if you try to hit a forehand at your chest, it's a lot tougher than a backhand, which is pretty easy. So I'm not saying that you shouldn't be sliding to the right when you hit a one-handed backhand counter at your chest. I'm saying that if you have a two-handed backhand on the right, you actually have the privilege of sliding farther to your right when you do slide. And in essence, covering more court, being able to counter effectively on more court when you're on the right. So the reason for that is, if you slide to the right, and the sidelines here, you're ready to counter on the right, you're sliding, and then you try to reach all the way over here. We all know that the more that you reach to your left with, you know, given that you're a righty with a one-handed backhand counter, the weaker you get. This is easy, this is all right, and then as you reach out here, it gets tougher. So really, when you slide to the right, you're only covering the chicken wing and then anything that is almost whatever is in between your shoulders or close to your left shoulder. And then outside of this, you would just leave it for your left side partner. And that's what we're taught to do. That's what the best right side players in the game do, at least the ones without two-handed backhands. That's what they do. And that's great. But if you have a two-handed backhand, this weakness out here actually becomes a strength. So if you're going to be just camping out and just only ready for the backhand, saying anything going over my right shoulder, that's out, which is what you should be doing on the right, as long as, you know, you're experienced enough to feel comfortable with that, then you can actually slide really far, because anything over here with a two-handed backhand, you're able to cover really well. So I think that it's easier, and I found this to be the case when I was playing the right, it's easier to cover starting at your body, and then if you see it go middle, you put two hands on it and you hit a two-hander. It's easier to go, okay, my two options are a one-handed backhand counter when it's in between my shoulders, and then when it goes to the left of my left shoulder, I'll put a two-hander on it. That switch is a lot easier, in my opinion, than backhand switching forehand. If you maybe, let's say that it's to the right of my right shoulder, maybe I'll switch forehand. I think this is a lot messier than just saying, okay, anything to my, literally going to stand almost close, right on the sideline, so that I'm as safe as I could possibly be. And then if it's here, I'm good. And then I'll just put a second hand on and hit a two-hander. I think because you can slide farther, since you have more countering ability when it's a foot to your left with a two-handed backhand, that is a huge advantage in having a two-handed backhand when you're playing on the right side of the court. So that's why I was confused, because people were saying, James, you know, if you have a two-handed backhand, it's a waste of a two-handed backhand to be playing on the right side of the court. And hey, maybe if you have a two-handed backhand dink, then it is a waste, because you're not going to be hitting a lot of two-handed backhand dinks on the right side of the court unless you're a guy who's playing mixed and you're trying to take the middle with your two-handed backhand, which is something that I do sometimes, but rarely. So that's all. All in all, it is not a waste. If you have a two-handed backhand, know that you can slide further to the right when you are playing the right, because you can cover more that is to your left when you have a two-handed backhand. And if you have any questions on that, leave those questions in the comments. That's it. So we have another topic here. So, okay, somebody asked me, what separates the best players in the world, maybe like the top two or three or four or five players in the world, from those that are in the top 20? And I think it's interesting, because pickleball is such a, you know, it's a small sport. There's not a lot of great players. And I would argue that the difference between the number one and number 10 player in pickleball, at least on the, actually on either side, men's or women's side, is bigger in terms of just pure skill level, which is tough to quantify. So this is just my personal opinion. But that difference between the first ranked player in pickleball and the 10th ranked player in pickleball is actually larger in terms of just pure skill level than the difference between the number one tennis player in the world and the number 100 tennis player in the world. So the reason for that is, I think it's because it's such a small sport. There is not a lot of people who have actually tried to get good. And if you look at the people in the top 10, I'm sure that we're quite talented, but I don't really think, you know, it's nothing like football or basketball, where there are so many people around the country, or even in the case of basketball, or soccer around the world, trying to get really good at a sport, doing everything they can for their entire lives to do it. Not the case in pickleball. In pickleball, there are players in the top 10 who have been playing pickleball for 2 years. So what that lends itself to is a pretty big discrepancy in skill level as you go down the rankings, because it's not a solved sport. It's not something that, you know, like, basically what I'm saying is, the players that are number 20 in the world in pickleball or 30 in the world, they're not as good as they can be. And I think they're going to get better. And I think in 2 years or 3 years, the sport's going to be more even and there's going to be some more upsets. And I think that because pickleball matches are so short, there's going to be more upsets because there's more that can happen. So I think that'll be fun. But right now, the discrepancy in skill level is so big because the game is still so small that these upsets don't happen. So people are complaining, Ben and Anna Lee win every time. Well, that's the case now. And I think it probably will be the case for a little while because they've been playing for 8 years each, right? And the, you know, me being a top three player, I've been playing for 2 years and a few months. So it's just it's a very unique situation. And it's not to say that they won't keep winning. I mean, they might, but I think that the discrepancy will, you know, that gap will shrink just by nature of time. So if you're one of the people that is really tired of the Ben and Anna Lee show, well, first of all, I don't know why you would be, because I think it's pretty cool to see, you know, how great they are. And then they're also both humble. And I think that they're great just representatives of what the sport is. I really do, having, you know, knowing them personally, I'd have every reason to not like them because they beat me all the time. And, you know, I should be tired of them and I should hate them, but really, no, I think they're great. They both are. They're good. They're the right people to be at the top of the sport right now. But just, you know, as time passes with all these players that are training and training, you know, the sport takes time and it takes time to improve at anything. So I think that that gap in level will continue to shrink, whether it's between, you know, me and Ben or anybody that's, you know, the number 10 player and the number one player. Because right now that gap between the number one player and the number 10 player is so huge. And that's what makes, you know, some people upset with the whole Ben and Annalise show, this and that. That's going to go away. And now I'm on a tangent and I'm not even answering the question. The question was, what separates the number? I guess I sort of answered the question. The question is, what separates the best of the best from, say, maybe the number 20 player in the world or even the number 10 player in the world? So I guess I did answer the question because partially it's repetitions. Just the fact that the number one player on the men's side and on the women's side has been playing for 8 years. And that's quite a long time to be doing something like pickleball, which is, you know, if you look at the top 10, there's not... You know, for me, I've been playing for 2.5 years. There's a lot of new players coming in that are having some success. But if you don't have those repetitions, it's just harder to do something. The more you've done something, the easier it gets. That's just how the brain works. So number one, I would say, is repetitions. And I think just consistency, just playing well more often than not. And always doing the right things on the court because you've done it so many times, and playing well down the stretch and just being disciplined, you know, making your drops. I think it's funny. The thing that separates players, I think, most in any level is actually just the transition zone. It's a tough part of the game. You know, dropping the ball in from different parts of the court isn't easy. You know, dinking's not easy either, but it's easier than dropping the ball in. And I think that the transition game of guys like Ben or you know, Colin even, or Anna Lee, it's really good. It's definitely better than mine. So I think the transition zone, repetitions, consistency down the stretch, and just, you know, overall just playing the right way and doing the right things and not making dumb decisions. And I think that comes with time. So I think it does all kind of tie back to the idea of repetitions and having played the game for so many years. So, and of course, that's not the only separator. I think a big separator, just in terms of players in the top five or players in general, is always going to be your power and your hand speed and things that are not necessarily something you can teach or improve as much. You know, you're not really going to be able to improve your top end power as much as you might be able to improve your resets, right? It's just some of the things are genetic factors, right? So they kind of go hand in hand, the genetic factors and like the discipline and the repetition and things like that. So let's see. Trying to go through this podcast pretty quick because I have to write another newsletter. Last one is, what makes a good forehand speed up? So this is a good question because I am usually facing forehand speed ups. I'm on the left, so I'm playing against right siders that have great forehand speed ups. And one of the things is actually deception. So if you watch Gabe Tardio, you know, Gabe Tardio and Andre, they had great wins over Ben and Colin. They beat Thomas Wilson and Riley Newman. They had this great run to the final. And one of the things about Gabe's speed up is that it's very tough to read because he will take a big swing almost every single time. And one out of three of those big forehand swings that Gabe takes, he will just try to hit you with the ball, which is the exact same thing that I do. And it's totally a fair play at the pro level. It's just going for the full bag, as it's said. So it makes it tough. You know, if it always looks like he's going to take a big swing and crush the ball. And then you're thinking, oh, do I get out of the way? Do I not get out of the way? And then two out of three of those times, the speed up's going in. I think that makes it pretty tough. So that's one thing, just deception in general. And deception not in terms of whether or not I am speeding the ball up. I think that is a factor. But as you get better, players are usually going to know when you're speeding the ball up and when you're not, right? So that's another thing that I think we should have a separate podcast about even, is all these people who are saying, oh, well, they knew I was going to speed the ball up, right? Like I hit a dink and then I didn't disguise my speed up as a dink or make my speed up look like it wasn't going to be a speed up. That is, I mean, maybe you can hide your speed up and maybe you can make it, you know, almost impossible for someone to tell whether you're going to dink or speed up. But in the long term, that is probably not the best way to be speeding up the ball. I think the best speed ups are actually the ones where You know, maybe you know that it's coming and maybe you don't. I'm rarely trying to hide the fact that I'm speeding the ball up. It's just the deception factor is, where is it going? And how hard is it being hit? Those are the factors, and that's how you want to deceive someone when you're speeding the ball up. I think if you're trying to hide your speed up and you're trying to make it look like a dink right before you speed the ball up, you're really only hindering your own success at the speed up. Probably you're only hindering your ability to pick a target and hit a good speed up. I see people trying to, you know, hide and look down when they're about to speed up, and then they'll miss the speed up or they'll hit a bad spot. It's like, no, the primary factor here, the first thing that we do when we speed up the ball is we try to hit it well and into a good spot. Because if I hit a good speed up to a good spot and I'm not entirely telegraphing where it's going, then I'm probably going to be fine whether they knew that it was coming or not. I mean, you look at the best speed ups in the game, you have Ben John's backhand roll. You know that he's going to hit a backhand roll, JW's backhand flick, or maybe my two-handed backhand speed up, or Riley's two-handed backhand speed up, Matt or Dylan's forehand speed up. You know that a speed up's coming. The best speed ups are, there is no disguise as to whether or not a speed up is coming. They make it abundantly clear that they're going to speed the ball up, but it's just, we don't know where it's going. It's hard to read where the ball is going and how fast the ball would be hit. So that's a hugely important thing here. I should actually have a whole separate podcast on this topic because it means a lot to me. I get this question so much. Oh, they knew a speed up was coming. Yes, it's not about that. It's about where the speed up is going. If they know where the speed up is going, that's the problem. If they know that it's coming, well, it's not a problem at all if they don't know where it's going. So that's all. We're going to end it there. And if you have any questions, as always, leave them in the comments. And that's it. Thank you for tuning in.